Mentally, the highs and the lows are the hardest thing, you know, supporting Bowie on the main stage at Glastonbury, you know. Being backstage and just looking across at the porter cabin 30 yards away and Mr. David Bowie just coming out of that in a jeans and a T-shirt, just looking as cool as you can imagine. Oh, it can't get much higher than that. And then the album after that, getting a call on Rick's birthday saying we've been dropped, and then playing the Albert Hall when we were dropped. You get all these really weird things that happen, and you've just got to keep your eye on what you're doing and make sure we do what we do as well as we can. The fans, again, they're the people that keep us doing what we do, without a shadow of a doubt.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Radiohead, Elbow, The 1975, Bob Dylan and Kraftwerk. Today we're joined by drummer of Embrace, Mike Heaton, a band who has probably influenced me more than any other, and today we'll be reflecting on one of the most majestic debut albums ever recorded, The Good Will Out, memories of playing the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury immediately before Bowie's iconic headline slot, details of the new material coming out right now, and we'll finally find out whose ideas were the kazoos. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Mike Heaton. Thanks for joining us today, Mike. How's it going?
It's fantastic, and thanks for having us on the podcast, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. So the new single is called We Are It.
Yeah.
What is it and how do I obtain it?
That's interesting. What is it? How you can obtain it is you can stream it wherever you want when it's out. No, it's interesting. I don't comment too much on the lyrical side of things because obviously Dan is the sort of the lyricist in the band. But the whole theme of the album, you know, how to be a person like other people, is kind of about finding yourself and realising what you are. I know Dan, he's talked about this a lot, the fact that he went through years and years of kind of feeling a bit isolated, a bit different, and, you know, and then getting married and having kids and everything's focused, basically, and to realise that, yeah, how to be a normal person, you know, because you can, particularly from singers, more so than, you know, I love doing what I do because I can sit at the back and kind of, you know, take a back seat a lot of the time and don't have to be in front. I can't think of anything worse than standing at the front of the stage in front of loads of people. But you have to be a certain type of person to do that. And, you know, and I think he's learned a lot over the last few years about how to be a kind of normal person, if you like. You know, not that he's not normal, but he's kind of found that realisation of real life through finding somebody, falling in love and having a couple of children. It's made a massive difference to his life. And We Are It is just, we all think it's one of the strongest songs on the album. And it's exciting. The song excites us. We were rehearsing it yesterday. I know this podcast won't be as it is today, but, you know, we're playing Bingley on Friday, basically. You know, a second headline there. And we were rehearsing We Are It for the first time. We played it together yesterday. And it was just such a buzz. We finished playing it and we were all like, wow. Because when in the studio, we went in, the idea was there, we laid it down, it was done basically very quickly. So we never really learnt it, if you like. We just played it, went, oh, this part works. Even to the point where Rick, our guitarist who's produced it and mixed it, said he didn't even have time to really get the mic set up as he would normally for the kit because we were just laying down demos. And then it just happened and it was done. And we just sat back and went, oh, okay, wow, that's fantastic. So the whole story about the lyrical content, I will have to hand that over to Danny at some point. But in terms of energy, that's the sort of energy that we, you know, that we love from this album. And it does cover a lot of different areas. When you hear it, you know, we've got like a stripped back piano vocal called Remember Me. The first song on the album, Death Is Not the End, is an absolute belter. It's just so much fun to play and so powerful. And then the actual title track, I think, is kind of reminiscent of the track The Good Will Out because it's got that big building anthem with what will be, hopefully, a big sing-along ending. You know, obviously, we're kind of fairly well known for those. But this one feels to me like that. It's been a while because, obviously, because of COVID, we can't wait to get back out. So, yeah, we're still very excited about the album.
Make my bed with the devil. Now I know that we are it. Everything I lose, everything I win, everything I do, I know we are it. And everything I choose, everything I did, it brought me back to you.
What were you trying to consciously do differently this time, or in which ways was the production? Did you have pre-production meetings where you said, okay, let's not do X, but we will try Y? Was there anything you were consciously trying to do differently this time?
We were consciously not second-guessing ourselves all the time. One thing that we've been very guilty of, and, you know, if I could change anything, it would probably be the amount of time sometimes we spent on songs trying to get the absolute best out of the song, when sometimes you just need to... You know, in the past, you know, we'd record something and we go, oh, that's great. Oh, maybe what if we tried it in this style, or tried that, or tried a different key and tried that? And we go around the houses, and sometimes we come to a better place, but a lot of the time you come back to, you know, nearly where you started. Whereas this time round, you know, we were all doing other things, so we were aware of everyone's time constraints. We'd spent lockdown firing song ideas backwards and forwards, so we had all the ideas in place. We just went in. And if we played it and it sounded great, we went, that's it.
And that's the classic behavioural kind of trait of perfectionists, isn't it? And I remember in the If You've Never Been album, you re-recorded two of the singles. So you had, I think, Wonder and Make It Last. You went back and recorded it, and they were great. And they were a bit, you know, there was a bit more production to them and that kind of thing. And sometimes maybe it takes someone else to make a decision or a timeline to say, OK, we haven't got time to do this because we've got other, you know, other things going on. So we need to do it in this time. And then, you know, you smashed it out and it sounds like it's going to be good. Yeah, so
I couldn't agree more. And it does happen so often. We've re-recorded numerous songs over the years. I mean, good people had three versions of it and they did get better. So that it was the right thing to do. But then you don't know if we'd have made those decisions and cut those corners and done things differently, would we have ended up where we are now? Would we have burnt out and disappeared before now if we'd have done that? Would we have been the size of Coldplay? Would we be just playing in a pub around the corner? I don't know. It's impossible. There's no way of finding out. But in hindsight, I wish we'd spent less money and got to the point more quickly. But we've always asked for complete artistic control from our labels we've been with. They've kind of left us to our thing. And sometimes, I have to say, I think personally, you know, we were left with too much time to do things. We spent, you know, best part of £500,000 on the first two albums recording them. And on the second album, the record company hired a mansion in the Cotswolds, 12 weeks, and let us put a studio in it. And when we said, oh, can we have living catering? Went, yeah, what do you want? You know, table tennis tables, what, pinball machines? Yeah, I have two of those. You know, the Ashes video cost £120,000. And at the time, we were looking around going, what are all these people on this set for? People just seem to turn up. You know, for bands that had only just been signed, it's insane. And it would never happen nowadays. And what you learn as you go on as a musician is that we might be borrowing it from the record label, but we are paying for everything. We pay it back. This lady who said, oh, yeah, you can use my old garage round the back. He had a friend who used to rehearse in there. And we went round there, and it was just literally... no disrespect to her, because it was lovely of her to let us use it, but it was just stacked high with just stuff, basically. And we just put up a green bit of cloth for the green screen, and we just performed in front of her, who said, you know, we are it. Like, that video that we've just done cost less than £1,000. It literally came about so quickly. That video was literally shot in a wooden shack in Bradford that Mickey Dale, he knew this lady who said, oh yeah, you can use my old garage round the back. No disrespect to her, because it was lovely of her to let us use it, but it was just stacked high with stuff, basically. And we went round there and just put up a green bit of cloth for the green screen, and we just performed in front of it for 3 hours, which is the quickest video we've ever shot in our lives. Each of us did a performance, and then a guy called Alex, who's their video editor, he then had the task of spending nearly 3 months making it into what it is now. And we all think it's probably the best video I've ever made, which is unusual for a band that have been together for, this is my 31st year in the band, actually.
on that topic, you might respond by saying, okay, we kept doing it the same way.
Yeah.
So super fans have embraced travel up and down, seeing the secret gigs, everything could tell you, every quarter, every B-side, everything like that.
Yeah.
And obviously there was this band called Coldplay who really were quite influenced by you lot. And then they started doing really well. And then by about your fourth album, Chris Martin basically offered up a song to you guys called Gravity, which obviously you recorded and released. And I remember as a fan at the time thinking, I don't know how that sat with me, because I felt you had so many great songs yourself that they should, you know, Danny and Richard are such great songwriters, and all between you do some great stuff. Looking back, do you think that was, you know, something, did you, was that a decision that was debated, discussed, whether you should do that? But obviously it was a huge hit, so.
Yeah, I agree. We've done cover versions for Radio Sessions. And Danny came to us and said, look, Chris has asked if we want this song. He doesn't think it really suits them. They can't get a handle on it. We were all a bit, okay, great song. So we tried it. We demoed it. Of course, at the time, they'd blown up and they were huge. So the record label got hold of it. And obviously they just went, yeah, this is it. We've done cover versions for Radio Sessions. We did Three is a Magic Number and How Come for Radio 1. But this is the only song that we've actually done as a proper bona fide embrace song, if you like, that somebody else wrote. We went in with Youth and recorded it as part of Out of Nothing. It felt weird for me at first doing it. That album has got so many great tracks on it. It wasn't as though Gravity was a standout track. In fact, personally, on that album, it's probably not the two, three or four songs that I think are far better. But then it came to the single choices for the album, and we wanted to go with Ashes first. For Gravity, the record label argued and got their own way in the end. And they were right. You know, it kickstarted our career again after a 3.5-year hiatus, and it worked well because of the success it brought and helped us with. It became our song. You know, and Chris has been good to us over the years. You know, invited us to play at the Principality Stadium a few years ago, which is a great experience. So, fair play. You know, he did us a lot of favours, and they're a great band, and they deserve to be where they are.
And on that, the single choice is really interesting. So I've travelled up and down the country to embrace, and this leads me on to my next question, that I've never seen a band interact with their fans in the same ways as you do. And I remember being backstage, actually having a drink, and it was the Hammersmith Palais show. It was just before they shut it down. And I was chatting to Richard, and he said to me, he said, what do you think the next single should be? What a lovely question. And I said, Looking As You Are. And he said, well, deciding tomorrow, I think it should be Someday. And I said, oh, I think it should be Looking As You Are. And they did actually choose Looking As You Are, but up to all that was nothing to do with us. But I wonder what the decision-making process, like, is it a case that Danny says, I really want this, and, you know, between all of you decide, and then someone else actually ultimately makes the decision from the record label? Like, how does that work? That, because it's a big decision.
It's changed over the years. You know, in the early days, it was very much a joint decision between us, the management, and the record label. You know, everyone had a view. And then it was like, you know, whoever shouted loudest got their way. You know, in the States, the record labels over there, they went with Ashes and then Gravity. They wanted to do it differently. Wrong decision. If we'd have done that in the States, it would probably have blown up a lot more than it did, basically. Back in the day, yeah, there were a lot of heated discussions, shall we say, between management, band, and record label. I'm sure it is the same for many bands, as to what should be the single. Sometimes, you know, we did the wrong thing when we pushed for it. You know, I think famously I was driving back to the station from the studio with Jazz Summers, who was managing us at the time, and he said, look, Save Me should be the first single off Drawn From Memory. We went with Hooligan. It's bonkers. It's bonkers. You know, Rick was singing it, sounded nothing like Embrace. It had kazoos on it. But at the time, it was a lot of fun. We just had a massively successful album, but we thought we could do anything at the time.
Whose ideas were the kazoos?
It was quirky. You know, it was quirky. It was something a bit different. Kind of think it might have been Rick's idea. But then again, Danny might say it's his idea. Because my memory is not as brilliant. In my mind, I would say it came from Jimi Hendrix and Crosstown Traffic. Whether that was a kazoo, I've no idea. I think it might have been just a comb with a piece of, you know, a tracing paper on it, whatever they used to do. We had loads of kazoos made and gave them to the audience. But you might even have one still.
I love Hooligan. I think it's an absolute cheer. Yeah. It's almost like not a publicity stunt, but it was very much, oh, there's a song with a kazoo and it's a single. Who is that? Oh, it's Embrace. Oh, okay. So I kind of think it did work in a way. What's your song that you most enjoy playing off that album?
One of my favourite tracks we've ever recorded is I Had a Time, which I still think to this day I can listen to it and it just sends goosebumps down my spine. It's fantastic. But Yeah You is great. There's actually a live version that we did for, I think it was the Bratz tour at Shepherd's Bush Empire, or MTV, you know, it was an MTV thing, that's knocking around, which is fantastic, which was done, you know, around about the time. So I come from like a rock and punk background, I still love that recording because it's got a bit more edge than the album version. And when we came back and started playing it again a few years ago, I was in my element. I love playing that. So yeah, the rocky stuff gets my vote.
Where does your creative process come into recording with Embrace? So is it a case that the band produce demos and then you choose? Because I always think, well, there's a song of yours called Satellites, which is probably one of my favourites of yours. And I actually think the moment that actually that makes that song is when your snare comes in. And I'd be really interested, was that your decision as to when the snare comes in? I think it just lifts the song so nicely. Or is that something that's collaborative, or how does it work?
Satellites was a tricky one. We took a while to get that. And do you know what? I don't know if we've played that live, because it was difficult to get that subtlety. And like you say, just certain little things coming into it and making the difference. But that's the beauty of good production on that album. We worked with Ken Nelson, who had just done the first two Coldplay albums, which is why we got him on board. Now, the only downside to that was he's a lovely fellow, great producer, but he told us that he had to slow Coldplay down to get that majesty because they played everything a bit fast. Now, with us, we had that tendency to play slow anyway. So when he slowed us down, sometimes it was a bit too far, but great production. And in tracks like that, and Mike Hunter as well, we worked with, you know, it was just it's subtlety. You know, it's just, like you say, little things coming in here and there, making all the difference. And the mood that that song creates, I think, yeah, a brilliant bit of songwriting by Rick.
As a drumming tutor, what's your kind of stance on getting different time signatures into songs? So, is it something you try and push to the band to do something that's not in?
People can't dance to it. You know, generally, that's the thing. You know, it kind of, you know, it has that sort of jerky effect by going to, you know, whatever, 5, 4, 7, 8 or whatever weird time it's beyond that. So, no, I don't think I've ever suggested doing anything in a weird time signature, probably because I know what the answer would be. and in fact, while I'm talking, I'm thinking, have we ever done anything in an odd time signature? Danny's very much four chords and the truth. Doesn't want to learn any other chords. You know, he knows he's, yeah, probably not four, but, you know, he's handful of chords, and he sticks to that.
Many will learn. I remember seeing Richard do it at Maid of Ale and saying that I've got to really concentrate on this because I've got to go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Triplets.
One, two.
It's not time signature. It's in triplets, yeah. So, yeah, he's playing da 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 oh, yeah. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But I'm playing 1, 2, 3.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So there. But that's about as odd as it gets with Embrace in terms of the time signatures. But the songs, they work as they work. So, you know, again, going back to that thing, maybe if we work on Gravity and go, let's try it in 5-4 time, probably wouldn't have worked. But from the teaching point of view, I do teach odd time signatures because I do enjoy jamming and playing with them. But my teaching is very much about how to play in a band rather than how to learn all the technical stuff. Because first and foremost, I'm a band player. I'm not a technician. I was self-taught for the first 2-3 years, and then I went to one drum tutor, didn't get on with him, so I didn't learn anything. Went to another great drum tutor, but he was all about the rudiments and stuff, and I wasn't interested in that. So then I didn't have any more lessons until we were probably about 3 albums in, maybe. And I suddenly realised I couldn't do all the things that my heroes like John Bonham and Neil Peart could do. And I realised it was because I hadn't learnt the rudiments, I hadn't learned the basic building blocks of drumming. Whether that would have made my playing better on the earlier albums, probably not, because, you know, simple was best. You know, if I'd have known too much, I may have tried to complicate things. You know, and it's an old saying, but you've got to play for the song. You know, and I've said to a lot of bands that come in here and record, you know, if you play somebody your demo and say, what do you think of this song? At the end of it, they go, oh, drumming's great. Chances are you're not playing the right parts because you should be listening to the song, you know, not the single instrument. So it's something I had to learn with Embrace, because the band I was in previous to that band called Big Spread were like a funk band with Elvis on vocals. And
sounds great.
it was really good until the singer got deported. We did a 5-4 and had some more sort of funky Chad Smith-esque drumming on that. And then when we actually found our sound with, you know, things like retread and stuff, I had to pair it right back, and getting used to playing really simple grooves was tough at first, but then you learn to, pardon the pun, embrace that side of things and enjoy just keeping simple time. You know, sometimes there's no substitute for just playing some sort of nice, simple groove. You can kind of just get into it. And the more simple the groove, the easier it is to do. So you can enjoy the gig more. And you're not completely focusing on learning how to do these, you know, fancy parts. But there are some on this album, actually, Death Is Not the End. The opening track was actually, the demo was recorded for the Tallies album, and we never used it. And when we were doing the Patreon thing, we came around and found all these tracks and went, why haven't we used that? So that drum part that's on this album was recorded in 2013. So I had to go back and learn it, and we chopped it all up and messed about it, and it's a bugger to play. But now, touch wood, I think I've got it, and it's great. The energy and the power is great. So, you know, and that just shows how long sometimes songs have to gestate until they get to where they need to be.
It's always interesting because a lot of the early Embrace stuff was quite slow. And then I think as the band has progressed, it's a lot more kind of the hi-hat and the BPM definitely increases. And actually, you still had this kind of like raucousness at your gigs, even when you're playing slower songs. And the evidence of that is, although I'm wearing glasses right now, I normally wear contact lenses. And the reason I wore contact lenses for the first ever time is I saw you at Brixton Academy.
Yeah.
And the second song you did was My Weakness Is None of Your Business. And someone crowd surfed and they kicked my head accidentally and it snapped my glasses. And I had to watch the remainder of the gig, which was probably another 20 songs, holding my glasses, pogoing, jumping up and down. And after that, I thought, okay, I'm just going to get contact lenses. And I pretty much wore contact lenses ever since that day. But even for a song like My Weakness Is None of Your Business, which is obviously quite a slow song, yeah, there's like the crowd get pretty raucous about it. And I'm interested if you were to see a young musician coming through now and think about yourself when things started really taking off for you. Like, when you reflect, how do you feel you changed in that moment when people maybe started recognising you, and compared to there was a fork in the road moment and, you know, the band didn't take off? How do you think you changed as a person, if at all?
Oh, that's an interesting, deep question. How did I change as a person? You don't feel it, for sure. I think it was less pronounced probably for myself and Steve and Mickey, because obviously, you know, Danny was the one that got the brunt of the fame, if you like. And Rick being a brother, he got a lot of it as well. I think when we first started out, it was a very easy sell to put us with two northern brothers who were arrogant, you know, after Oasis had just gone absolutely huge. Probably one of the reasons that we got a lot of interest, you know, we had the songs to back it up as well. Confidence and arrogance can get mixed up very easily. And we were doing it because we thought we were the best band out there. And we were writing the best songs. So I don't think I changed as a person. You know, I just thought I just had a great time doing what we were doing, really. And I definitely feel like the same person I was when I first started. What I can say is, you know, all the friends that live in my area are friends from growing up. You know, some people from when I was born, some from 4 years old, 10 years old. And we all hang out together and we all do the same things that we used to do. I would just say to anyone who really hits that big time, you got to look at your family and friends that you knew before and make sure that they still like the person that you are. If you turn around and suddenly they've all disappeared and you've just got a whole new set of friends that are just sycophants, then, you know, maybe you've gone in the wrong direction. One of the questions we've been asked a lot is, how come we're still the same, you know, five members of the band since we got signed, basically? And, you know, we like to have fun, we like to have a drink, we still do, but we never went down that excess route of drink, drugs, etc. We never took it too far, you know. Becoming that person that has got that, you know, that rock star ego and that expects people to pander to them, I just don't like it. I know when we were talking to Dave Boyd, who's at Hut Records, who signed us, you know, he was saying that, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, when they signed to Hut over in this country, you know, his ego went through the roof and was very difficult to deal with. So I would say to people, try and keep yourself grounded. Don't become an arsehole, basically, because a lot of people do.
You've seen it from that perspective. And yeah, that's super interesting. Would you say there's a particular price you pay for doing this job? So, you know, growing up, you probably thought this is kind of the dream job to have. Do you think there's other sacrifices that you've made or hurdles you've had to overcome that have been kind of bumps in the road that actually you weren't aware of when you went to embark in the music industry?
The highs and the lows are the hardest thing. Highs and lows, being away from your family. You know, I was just chatting to somebody earlier, a drum tech, working with a few big bands, and, you know, he was going through a divorce. If you're working away all the time, it can be difficult for partners, etc. But mentally, you know, when we were doing Recording Out of Nothing, we kind of ran out of money. It was a really kind of desperate time. I had a young family, a mortgage, etc. And those sort of lows can be pretty hard to deal with. But having said that, supporting Bowie on the main stage at Glastonbury, you know, it can't get much higher than that. And then the album after that, if you'd never been, you know, getting a call on Rick's birthday saying we'd been dropped, and then playing the Albert Hall when we were dropped. You get all these really weird things that happen, and you've just got to keep your eye on what you're doing and make sure we do what we do as well as we can. And that seems to have kept us you know, signed. And going back to the fans again, they're the people that keep us doing what we do, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, if they weren't there and they weren't supporting us, we wouldn't be here.
You talked about there's no higher you can get than supporting David Bowie on Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury, but there is one place you could have been higher than that, which is Bowie had laryngitis that week, and it was very touch and go as to whether he was actually going to play the set, which might have meant that you kind of stepped up into that slot, which would have been fantastic. And I remember the sun was setting and it was a great show. What are your kind of biggest, kind of fondest memories, if you like, of that day, and your biggest takeaways when you reflect on that particular show?
It was being backstage in the enclosure that we were in, and sitting outside in the sun, and then just looking across at the porter cabin, which was like 30 yards away, and Mr. David Bowie just coming out of that in a jeans and a t-shirt, just looking as cool as you can imagine. You know, when he went on stage, I thought, oh, you've ruined it. You've got that bloody big, you know, Union Jack thing or whatever he was wearing. But he just walked out, jeans and a t-shirt, and I'm like, hang on a sec, I'm just standing, you know, and I'm just about to play before David Bowie. And then we were at the side of the stage, and Happy Mondays were on before, another band that we'd all kind of idolised, and going, Jesus, we're playing after these guys. Luckily for us, they weren't on form that day. But still, it was nerve-wracking, because it was the year when everyone broke in, so all the fences came down, and I remember looking out, and you couldn't see the end of the people. It was just like, they were never-ending. So, yeah, definitely a highlight of our career. And then doing the show, I literally can't remember the show. I can't remember the gig. I've watched it back, but I can't remember it. That was in, must have been some sort of days. But then going out and watching Bowie from, you know, the perspective of punter, and watching him, you know, trying to connect the two. I've just been on that stage, and now Bowie's on that stage. Very weird day, but what a fantastic thing to do.
Aside from that gig, if you could hypothetically go and stand in the audience and watch one of your gigs back ever that you've ever played, which would be the one you'd pick out?
I think, and again, it's good because it goes over the whole career. The two nights we did at the Millennium Square in Leeds in about 2005, I would have loved to have witnessed that from the crowd point of view, because, you know, we'd just really come back and we were on a massive high, and everyone was just so up for having a good time. You know, so those two nights were incredible. But also going back near the present, the Peace Hall in Halifax, we'd always said we'd love to play there because it's such an iconic building. It wasn't used really for anything band-wise or small bands. And then they got it back. So when we did the Peace Hall, it was sold out, and we had fantastic weather that day. And it was just incredible. You know, that was a massive high for us. So I'd love to see that.
Best get yourself into the mindset on the day of a really high profile gig, or if you're doing a TV show or something like that. Often bands arrive kind of hours and hours before the actual show, and there's a lot of dead time before the show in the evening. How do you best use that time that isn't drinking and whatever it might be, that can use up vital resources that you might need for the actual gig?
Obviously, we've always made sure that we are on point. But we did sort of drink a lot, and that's the trouble when you've got a lot of downtime, you know, and you're together. There's only been a couple of gigs where Rick woke up halfway through the gig because he'd had a bit too much to drink. I went, whoa, Jesus, I'm on stage. It's Brixton, you know, which he's famously talked about, so I'm not giving anything away. And sometimes, you know, I've drunk too much and you get on stage, but with the energy of the drums, it's gone in a song or two anyway. But yeah, a lot of the time, just chilling out, chatting, listening to music. It used to be walking around the town, you know, and going to look at music shops, you know, and just looking at browsing and, you know, looking for books or whatever. But yeah, it's just a lot of chatting. I'll do my warm-ups, you know, drum warm-ups before we go on to any show for 20 minutes beforehand, and annoy people in the dressing room with tapping on everything. The only thing we do have is before we go on stage, we all have a group hug and we jump up and down for a bit. Yeah, group hug, embrace. Yeah, jump up and down. Just kind of, we don't jump up and down as much as we used to do because we're getting older now. But, you know, but we get into it and we make sure we're all in the right space. And we used to say, right, three songs in, this is what we're going to be like. Bang, we need to do it from the first song. You know, so.
And that's the front cover to the Out of Nothing album, isn't it? That kind of huddle on the Out of Nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. Which was shot in a car park somewhere.
What do you think is one key quality that you would advise any musician to have? Now, it doesn't have to be technical, but going into the music industry, apart from being, you know, not being an arsehole, as you said earlier, what's one kind of quality or element to someone's personality you think that they could develop to succeed in the music industry?
Determination, you know, without a shadow of a doubt. And you'll probably find you'll get the same answer from a lot of musicians, because, like I say, it took us nearly 5 years from me joining to actually getting our management and then the record companies. So, and I nearly left in that time because, you know, I'd got to 25 and I was like, oh, I said, if I haven't made it, then that's it. I'll, you know, get a day job. And it's determination. Danny said a lot before, you know, sometimes you have to bash head against the wall until the wall comes down, you know, and that's what I say to a lot of young bands, you know, it's hard work. I can guarantee just about every band that's made it has had to work their arse off to get there. There are very few of these stories where, you know, a record executive was walking past somebody's bedroom window and heard singing and signed them and they were a millionaire in a year's time. You know, they are very few and far between, I'm sure. The vast majority of people have to work hard, and you have to continue to work hard all the way through your career, because every album has to be as important as the last one, and you've got to put the energy into and make it as good as it can be. So, yeah. Determination, really, I would say, is the key to it. Stamina, determination.
If the world was going to end tomorrow, what would be your biggest regret musically, having not got round to? And what are your kind of ambitions left, as well as obviously the new tour and the new album? What other musical ambitions have you left to kind of tick off?
Regrets. I was never asked to join the Sex Pistols or Led Zeppelin.
Good answer.
I'd like to play with more musicians. That's probably one little regret that, you know, we've just focused on Embrace for a long time. I'd like to collaborate and work with younger bands to hopefully give them a platform to move to the next level. Working with young bands, I think, really helps. You can see their enthusiasm and you can see what we had in them, you know, when they're young, and that's what you need. My son's a drummer, just about to go to BIM in Manchester, and he's got that, you know, that sort of closed vision thing. That's what he wants to do, and that's what you need. So, and also, I do the band Landsharks, and I've got another album written with Steve and another guy. So, I like the collaboration thing. I'd like to collaborate and work with other people. That's something I'd like to develop. But regrets, yeah, I don't know. Again, you can't have them. Like we said when we were talking earlier, you know, if things had been different, they could have gone in the wrong direction. We're all very blessed to still be here and doing what we love doing. So, yeah, I think I wish I'd have learnt more of my craft when I was younger. I think that would have made things easier. But, yeah, regrets.
What if you could change anything in the music industry? One thing that you could change in the music industry, if you're like president of the music industry for one day, what would you change?
That would be really simple. Just make, you know, the royalties change for the streaming services. Because I've got nothing against streaming services. I use Spotify. I think it's an amazing tool. You know, it means I can just find anything I want, whenever I want, and check it out. If they got the balance and the revenues came to the musicians that they deserve, A, you know, it would mean longevity for a lot of bands' careers. It'll mean more money, you know, for younger bands that are trying to start out and get there. You know, those are the key things. And for the whole jobs for the boys thing needs to disappear, where, you know, you've got various ticket agents who are owned by other ticket agencies who are connected to agents, who are connected to... Yeah, and it's all just money swilling around in the same old pockets. So, but the Spotify's, you know, other streaming services are available. But, you know, that, it's a great tool. You can't go back. A few years ago, I was working on a panel with an A&R girl from record label, and she said, oh, we need to re-educate people back into buying CDs. I'm like, what? Kids don't, you know, but paying for music doesn't even come into their, you know. I mean, that's a bit sad, because when I used to buy an album, and as you probably did, you know, you'd buy an album, you'd save your money up, and you'd listen to half the albums I bought when I was, you know, a teenager. I didn't like all the tracks when I first bought them, but I did by the time I'd finished listening to it endlessly, you know, because you understood the album. So that's a bit of a shame that that's gone, the album format. But yeah, just spreading the money out more evenly would be a really simple idea. You know, maybe BP should think about that as well. But anyway.
We'll begin to wrap up. A last couple of questions. What's the most important piece of kind of memorabilia or something that you have that means a lot to you in regards to the, you know, your music? So if the house is burning down or your studio is burning down, Is there something you think, oh, I was really proud of that, I've kind of kept that? Are you someone who holds on to stuff like that?
Yeah, notwithstanding, obviously, anything to do with the family. But in terms of music memorabilia, I've got a piece of paper that was written to me, a note from Lemmy, when Danny did Nevermind the Buzzcocks one time, a wine glass that Robert Plant drank out of. It's not stalkery or anything. But somebody I know used to drink in the same pub. And all the passes, you know, I always keep all the our tour passes and bands I go to see and tickets and stuff like that. All that side of things, you know, are just great things to just open a box and look back and go, wow, you know, I did that. You know, I'm trying to think if I've got anything by other people. I'm sure I've got other things lying around by other artists. But yeah, the memorabilia is the main thing, really.
The glass thing's an interesting one, because a few people have said that they've kind of kept cups that people and glasses that people were drunk at. And I planted a seed. So Abby from the Zootons got one of Ringo's. And then I was interviewing Wolfgang Fleur from Kraftwerk, and he left this glass of wine afterwards, and I kept it. And everyone thought I was a bit stalkery. Accidentally smashed it on New Year's Eve, which was a bit of a shame. But there we go.
I broke mine as well.
Oh, man. There we go. Join the club. There we go. So you've got a tour coming up pretty soon. How are you deciding the set lists?
Again, it's a difficult one. You know the back catalogue we've got. So it's difficult because you've got to weigh up what we want to play and what people want to hear as well. We know everyone's going to want to hear the big tunes, so that they've got to be in there, you know, just because. And we still love playing them, good people. I've been playing that for 26 years now, you know, still love playing it. You know, that's surely a sign that it's okay. But you say, so all the big tunes will be in there, but it's picking the other bits and pieces. Tunes off the new album, you know, we want to really, you know, we want to play a few of those because we're so proud of the new record and I think everyone's going to love it. But it's a difficult process. Yeah, coming back from a gig in, where did we play, in Glasgow the other week, we had a discussion and Danny, it was like, yeah, I know what we need to play. Trust me, lads, I know what we need to do. And me and Rick were saying, well, we should try doing things like, you know, Exploding Machines or something like that. He was like, people don't want to hear that, you know. So we have these discussions and we find a happy place, hopefully, which we know after the first couple of gigs, because you can gauge the reaction both at the gig and on social media afterwards. So it's a tricky one, but I think we've got a pretty good set. You know, we're happy.
Well, I can't wait to see it. So listen, so good luck with the tour. Good luck with the new album. You know, you played odd songs that mean a lot to a lot of people, and you know, thank you for the music you've given to the world, and you will continue to give to the world. If anybody did want you to play on one of their tracks or to get drum lessons from you, where do they need to go to?
Yeah, I did have a website, but I took that down because I was getting a bit too busy. I'm trying to do all because I've got the drumhead business as well, which is really taking off as well. But on my, just contact me through any social media. Anyone's interested in drum lessons, if I can fit them in, you know, and I've got the time, I love doing it. You know, if somebody's enthusiastic and they want to learn, I don't go. Like I said before, I don't go to all the you know, the fancy stuff. I'll teach the basics. I'll get them to where they need to be to play in the first band. I play bass and guitar as well, so I've got like a Royal Blood setup with pitch shifters and stuff. So, you know, it feels like they're playing in a band. But yeah, Facebook, direct message me, or Instagram. Yeah, those two are enough for people, aren't they? And yeah, if anyone wants me to play on the sessions, drop me a line. I'm here. I'm available.
And Mike's an absolutely brilliant drummer. So, yeah, thanks for joining us this afternoon. You know, thanks for giving up your time. Good luck with the rehearsals ahead of the tour. Look forward to seeing you on that tour. And best of luck with it. Thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left Podcast.
Thanks for asking me, Chris. Appreciate it. It's been good fun. See you on the tour.
See you on tour sometime.
Yeah. Okay.
Cheers.
Take care.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too as well.
Cheers, Mike.
Cheers, Chris. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.
This episode was mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes. Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving an endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.